First, I'll talk about the idea of Green New Deals, and then the pandemic warnings that were ignored. I share credit with Irina Slav of Oil Price and Yuri Friedman of The Atlantic for their contributions today. Gigawatt upon gigawatt of green hydrogen capacity is being planned across Europe, Asia, and Australia. According to proponents of this technology, green hydrogen, the kind produced through electrolysis powered by solar, wind, and other renewable energy sources, is the best way to decarbonize heavy polluter industries. There is much talk about the falling costs of solar and wind and how they will make green hydrogen viable very soon. But what nobody seems to want to talk about is water. Electrolysis is the process of breaking down water into its constituent elements, hydrogen and oxygen, using an electric current. The process is performed in an installation called an electrolyzer. When hydrogen advocates talk about the bright future of the technology, they focus on the costs associated with the electricity needed for the electrolysis. But electrolysis, besides electricity, needs water. Tons of water, literally. The production of 1 ton of hydrogen through electrolysis requires an average of 9 tons of water. But to get these 9 tons of water, it would not be enough to just divert to a nearby river. The water that electrolysis breaks down into constituent elements needs to be purified. The process of water purification, for its part, is rather wasteful. Water treatment systems typically require some 2 tons of impure water to produce 1 ton of purified water. In other words, 1 ton of hydrogen actually needs not 9, but 18 tons of water. Accounting for losses, the ratio is closer to 20 tons of water for every ton of hydrogen produced. Speaking of water purification, organic chemists explain that the simplest way to do this is by distilling it. This method is cheap because it only needs electricity, but it's not fast. And electrolysis, as I've pointed out, needs as much as 18 tons of water, not accounting for losses in the process, to produce 1 ton of hydrogen. That means the cost of water purification for the production of a ton of hydrogen would be $2,432. That's 2,065 euros. That's based on the assumption that the water would be purified using the cheapest method available. There are other, much faster methods, but they're also costlier. Other alternatives to distillation, according to chemists, are unreliable at this point. So providing the right kind of water for hydrolysis costs money. And while $2,400 per ton of hydrogen may not sound like much, the cost of purifying water is not the only water-related expense in the technology that seeks to make hydrogen from renewable sources. Besides being pure, the water to be fed into an electrolysis has to be transported to it. Transporting tons upon tons of water to the site of an electrolyzer means more expensive for the logistics. To cut these, it would make sense to pick a site where water is abundant, such as by a river or the sea, or alternatively, close to a water treatment facility. And that puts a limit on the choice of locations that are suitable for large-scale electrolyzers. But since electrolyzer, to be green, needs to be powered by renewable energy, it will also need to be in proximity to a solar or wind farm. These, as we know, cannot be built just anywhere. Solar farms are most cost-effective in places with a lot of sunshine, and wind farms perform best in places where there is sufficient wind. Needless to say, these places are not, as a rule, close to waterways, except offshore wind, which seems perfect for the production of green hydrogen. Unfortunately, offshore wind is also the costliest form of the three renewable sources, solar, onshore wind, and offshore wind, normally mentioned in the context of green hydrogen production. According to Rystad Energy, the capital costs of an offshore farm are twice as high as those of its onshore counterpart, and four times as high as the costs of a comparable solar installation. Not all costs associated with the production of hydrogen from renewable energy sources are the cost of those renewable energy sources. Water is the commodity that process needs. And it's a little odd that nobody seems willing to discuss the costs of that water, including the European Commission's Green Deal team. Even beginning to think about this would drive Ocasio-Cortez back to the bar, this time as a drinker. Perhaps the cost of water supply, storage, and purification is negligible compared with other costs that need to be addressed first. Yet, it's an actual cost that should be added to the total when estimating how far the technology of producing hydrogen from renewable electricity has progressed and how viable it has become. For now, experts appear to be unanimous that it's not viable, not without sufficient government support, tax money. Before we race head-on into a Green New Deal, all of this should be acknowledged and carefully thought out. Now, to my discussion on pandemics. Each time a pandemic has occurred, we had warnings, but we failed to heed them. When the inevitable results of the government's response to COVID-19 happens, it will conclude that signs of a coming crisis were everywhere. We were warned in 2012 when the RAND Corporation surveyed the international threats arrayed against the United States and concluded that only pandemics posed an existential danger and that they were capable of destroying America's way of life. We were warned again in 2015 when Ezra Klein, after speaking with Bill Gates about his algorithmic model for how a new strain of flu could spread rapidly in today's globalized world, wrote that a pandemic disease is the most predictable catastrophe in the history of the human race, if only because it's happened to the human race so many times before. If there was anything humanity could be certain of, that it needed to prepare for, to prevent for the deaths of lots of people in little time, it was this. We were warned again in 2017, a week before Inauguration Day, when Lisa Monaco, Barack Hussein Obama's outgoing Homeland Security advisor, gathered with Donald Trump's incoming national security officials and conducted an exercise modeled on the administration's experiences with outbreaks of swine flu, Ebola, and Zika. The simulation explored how the U.S. government should respond to a flu pandemic that halts international travel, upends global supply chains, tanks the stock market, and burdens healthcare systems, all with a vaccine many months from materializing. Monaco said, "The nightmare scenario for us, and frankly to any public health expert that would talk to it, has always been a new strain of flu or a respiratory illness because of how much easier it is to spread relative to other pandemic diseases that are not airborne." We were warned in 2018 on the 100th anniversary of the flu pandemic of 1918, which killed 50 to 100 million people around the world. We were served notice that the next plague was coming, with influenza the most dangerous possibility, even as the United States succumbed to forgetfulness and short-sightedness. Luciano Borio, then the Director for Medical and Biodefense Preparedness at the National Security Council, told a symposium that the threat of pandemic flu is our number one health security concern. Serving under a president who'd come to office on the pledge to wall off the United States, she noted that such a threat could not be stopped at the border. We were warned in 2018 and 2019 when the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security gathered public health experts, business leaders, and U.S. government officials for simulations of the devastating humanitarian, political, social, and economic consequences of fictional novel coronavirus that left tens of millions dead around the world. 2 months after the second simulation, a novel coronavirus emerged in China. We were warned again in 2019 of the grave hazards of a new influenza pandemic by the U.S. intelligence community in its annual worldwide threat assessment. They had also cautioned us in 2018 and in 2016 and in 2015 and in 2014 and in 2013 when intelligence officials pleaded, "This is not a hypothetical threat. History is replete with examples of pathogens spreading populations that lack immunity, causing political and economic upheaval." When the National Commission on the COVID-19 response is all in, it will differ from the 9/11 Commission in that it will conclude that the system was blinking red, not just in the inner sanctum of the U.S. intelligence community, but out in the open as well. And despite all of that, the U.S. government was not sufficiently prepared when the boogeyman, in this case the virus SARS-CoV-2, finally came calling. The systemic failure stems in part from the fact that in recent decades, successive administrations have not treated pandemic preparedness with the degree of seriousness they reserve for addressing other top security threats from, say, terrorists or adversarial nations. The pattern keeps repeating itself. Presidents rush to prioritize health security and to lavish money on it after crisis strikes. Then they scale back resources and succumb to complacency once it subsides. Pandemics don't occur with the frequency of other national security incidents, such as terrorist attacks, and therefore they often seem like a remote possibility, especially for elected officials thinking in the time horizon of their term in office. Responding to a catastrophic pandemic, as we will learn in the coming weeks, requires really changing the way we do a lot of things. It requires an all-out-of-society response. And until the crisis happens, it appears policymakers don't know how to do that. Funding for pandemic preparedness has long lagged behind other homeland security priorities. The government, for example, spends at least $100 billion a year on counterterrorism efforts versus $1 billion on pandemic and emerging infectious disease programs. This despite the fact that the new coronavirus threatens to kill vastly more Americans than terrorism ever has. The World Health Organization's definition of a pandemic is the worldwide spread of a new disease. This new coronavirus disease is infectious and contagious. The coronavirus pandemic is not the first to hit human civilization. Throughout history, there have been numerous pandemics, others much worse than COVID-19, that claimed the lives of millions of people. Ever since humans learned to live in groups, forming communities where they lived close to each other and travel across the seas, the world has seen numerous diseases spread like wildfire. In research, I found 10 pandemics that plagued humans in the past. It's not all of them, but the 10 worst. Number 10 was an Antonine Plague, which occurred between 165 AD and 180 AD. It was also known as the Plague of Galen. It was an ancient pandemic that broke out across the Roman Empire, through Asia, all Roman cities in Italy, and in Greece. Eventually, it reached Spain, Egypt, and North Africa, among other areas. At the height of that pandemic, it killed 2,000 people a day, at a time when the world was much less inhabited. Many believe it was caused by smallpox and measles. Number 9 was the Black Death from 1347 to 1352. It was this deadly pandemic that swept through Europe and Asia, among other continents, and killed an estimated 25 million people in Europe alone. Aside from having fever and chills, those affected also had blood and pus seeping out of swellings all over the body. Then at number 8 is the smallpox pandemic from 1870 to 1874. Before the world completely rid itself of this horrendous disease, it swept through continents, killing 3 out of 10 victims. Those who survived were left with deep scars, which were even found in 3,000-year-old mummies, showing that it had ravaged ancient civilizations for thousands of years. But it was in 1870, during the Franco-Prussian War, that smallpox spread throughout the world. From Europe, it reached Asia, through America, causing 500,000 deaths worldwide. Pandemic number 7 on a scale of which was worse is cholera. The first of 7 cholera pandemics emerged in India in 1817, according to the WHO cholera. It is an active diarrheal infection caused by the ingestion of contaminated food or water. 3 years after it spread throughout India, it reached different countries in Asia. In 1821, it was brought by British troops traveling from India even to countries outside Asia. At number 6 is the Russian flu from 1889 to 1890, called the first ever modern flu pandemic. The Russian flu, which started in St. Petersburg, spread through Europe, infecting even prominent world leaders. After a few months, it reached virtually every part of the planet. An estimated 1 million people died of Russian flu. Pandemic number 5 was the Spanish flu from 1918 to 1919. That flu is still considered the deadliest in history, infecting a full 1/3 of the world's population and killing 20 to 50 million people worldwide. It came in 3 waves. The first wave was almost like common flu and hit in the spring of 1918. The second wave, that appeared in the fall of the same year, was deadlier. It killed people within hours or a few days after the onset of symptoms. The third wave that came the following year was just as deadly and added more to the death toll. At number 4 is the H3N3 pandemic of 1968. This 1968 flu pandemic was caused by the influenza H3N2 virus. Although relatively not as deadly, this virus was highly contagious and spread throughout Southeast Asia within 2 weeks after it first emerged in Hong Kong in July 1968. By December, the virus had reached the United States, United Kingdom, and other countries in Europe. It killed an estimated 1 million people. Number 3 is the HIV/AIDS pandemic, first reported in 1981. Since then, HIV spread globally, infecting more than 65 million people. There is still no known cure for this sexually transmitted disease, but there are treatments that keep the virus under control, allowing people to live longer. Number two is the severe acute respiratory syndrome, known as SARS. It was first reported in Guangdong, China, as early as November 2002. After a few months, it spread throughout countries in North America, South America, Europe, and Asia. It infected 8,898 people worldwide and killed 774 people. This disease caused high fever, body aches, and dry cough, which then led to pneumonia in some cases. And then we come to the COVID-19 pandemic, which started in 2019. Coronavirus is believed to have originated in Wuhan, China. It spread throughout Europe, the rest of Asia, North America, and virtually every part of the world within months. It has inflicted over 2 million people and killed hundreds of thousands worldwide. This pandemic is still with us. Although great strides have been made to develop and produce a vaccine to combat it, these vaccines would normally have taken 3 to 7 years to bring to the market, but President Trump took out the red tape and got it to the market in a year. You can argue about Trump's combative personality all day long, but there is no argument about who's responsible for getting these vaccines fast-tracked. Joe Biden is on record saying that there were no vaccines available before he came to office. But Joe had already been given the shots himself before he came to office. Kamala told the same lie. Joe may be excused because his memory has more holes in it than a basketball net. In Kamala's case, it's simply a matter of ignorance. Thank you for listening today to this bonus commentary. I'll be back again next week, God willing. Same time, same station, and God bless America.